Good evening. Welcome to Racetrackers. I'm delighted to announce we have Steve Cawthon as our guest tonight. Good evening, Steve.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Fine, thanks. Steve, we're so happy to have you on the show tonight. It seems like only yesterday to a lot of us, but it was 40 years ago.
Yeah, right.
It was 40 years ago in 1977 for some of our listeners who are younger. When you set the world on fire in New York this month with an astounding, I believe it was 77 wins in the month of February, is that correct?
You know, I don't even know, but I do remember I had 23 in 1 week or something, but I can't remember about. I didn't know about the month.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a time. You know, now in New York, I don't even know if we run 77 races in the month of February. But you know, but back then. We're so happy to have you on, and you know, obviously your accolades are so many. It's hard to go through, and I don't want to embarrass you, but for our listeners, you've won every possible award that could be as a jockey, and really had the distinction of being Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year, which is something an Associated Press Male Athlete of the Year and a Sporting News Pro Athlete of the Year. It's the likes of notoriety that racing doesn't normally get in the wider range of things. So obviously, congratulations on that distinction.
Thank you. Yeah, it was an exciting time for sure.
I mean, when we speak about it, and again, so many of our listeners are younger, and you know, it was back in the day when we didn't have information that was so readily available. And if I remember correctly, when you were the leading apprentice in New York, and you know, in 1977, you would be listed. The entries didn't come out till the night before because the entries weren't taken very early, and there was no advanced daily racing form. But you would come out, and you would be listed on numerous horses at that time. Everybody wanted you to ride their horse. Do I recall that correctly, that you'd be listed on three or four horses?
Yeah.
And
I mean, that was, as you say, I think, you know, a lot of guys were trying to get me on their horse. And as you say, there was quite a few jockeys there, but, you know, they allowed my agent to do that. And then, you know, I think there was a certain time where they had to, you know, secure, you know, an exact jockey. Once, you know, we figured out what we were going to do. And then, you know, they had to, you know, everybody else had to get, you know, somebody else.
It's a scramble for all the other rides.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a tremendous run. And I remember, I don't know whether you recall this, but at least in racing circles, you know, the Eagles had a big song, said, you know, there's a new kid in town, and you were it. You know, when you came to New York, you kind of took it by storm. There was no question about it. And again,
yeah, it was crazy. I remember when I had to run, they made me go get my working papers. That was like a big deal, whether I was going to be able to get my working papers and
because
you
were too young to ride in New York, or you had to have working papers to ride in New York.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know. I was just it was just something that all of a sudden they said you have to do this or else you can't ride, and it was a big panic. And yeah, there was in the paper that, you know, there was a big caricature of it the next day. Boston gets his racing paper, his working papers.
That's great. Well, you know, there were, again, for our listeners who weren't around, it was so unbelievable because the numbers are different. But you earned $6 million in 1977. Your horses earned $6 million in purses.
Mm-hmm.
And that was considered unthinkable. I mean, you won like over 400 races, almost 500 races. But the $6 million number, and it coincided with a popular television show called The $6 Million Man, which was Lee Majors and I guess Farrah Fawcett. And I remember them.
Right.
Sports Illustrated saying, right, you were the new $6 million man.
Yep. That was, like you said, I think the Angel Cordero had the previous record, which was like 4 million something. So, yeah, it was at that time quite a step up. Like you said, nowadays it's like nothing, but it was, you know, like 487 races, I think it was. So
okay.
It was, I was working hard that year.
Yeah, no kidding.
But it was, like you said, it was, I think I won six races three times that year, maybe at Aqueduct.
amazing. Back when the stands were full most days too.
Yeah, right. Well, I was talking to somebody the other day. Even in the winter, you know, back in 77, 76, 77, that winter, you know, it wasn't unusual just on a regular weekday to have 10,000 people, you know, or 10 or 12,000 people. And on the weekends, you know, sometimes more. Of course, obviously the Wood, I think the Wood, you know, was more like 45 or 50,000 back then, you know.
Right.
And, I mean, you don't get that on the Breeders' Cup there, you know, not much more. So.
Right. It's all moved to television and on a computer.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure there's fewer people watching, but there's certainly fewer people
right,
watching.
No, right, yeah, right,
live.
Right, exactly. I'm just saying there that actually shows up at the racetrack, yeah.
Right. Well, if 1977 wasn't exciting enough for you, 1978 came along, and actually, late in 1977, you started riding Affirmed, and you started those battles
right.
with Affirmed and Allie Darren. And I think I saw all the New York ones as a kid, and I guess I kind of always thought that the only time Allie Darr seemed to beat Affirmed was an Affirmed didn't see him. And I think that happened once in his two-year-old career. I don't remember exactly what race it was, but he seemed like he passed
Champagne,
you far
yeah.
on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in the Champagne,
yeah.
he passed you far on the outside.
And it was a muddy track, too, which was another thing that wasn't Affirmed's favorite thing.
Okay.
You know, he ran on it, but he wasn't quite as confident and as you know, I just think he was, you know, better on a normal, you know, fast track. So, you know, there was kind of two things that day. But, yeah, you're right. Aladar, you know, came wide and on the outside. He got by me, and I didn't have time to, you know, to reengage. Just sort of he made such a, you know, he accelerated so well on that track that, you know, I just didn't have time to get back at him.
Right, and that set up kind of the rivalry. And when you moved into 1978, you know, again, for our listeners, you know all this, of course, but just for our listeners who may have been younger and have heard about it but not been around, you know, you were with Affirmed was owned by Harborview Farm, who was Lou Wilson and trained by Laz Barrera, and you were up against the old guard in Calumet Farm. Allie Darr was owned by Calumet Farm and John Veach, and there was probably, I think in the racing commentators, and there were only a few of them back then, there was probably a feeling that Allie Darr would get the better of Affirmed at some point due to his breeding and kind of a nostalgia back to Calumet being the,
yeah.
I don't think it was mean-spirited, but it seemed like it was always, no matter how many times Affirmed won, there were people saying, well, Allie Darr almost got there, or was going to get there, and throughout all that, you know, I guess no one told you and no one told Affirmed, right, that he was supposed
right.
to get passed
right.
by.
Thank God. Thank God.
You know,
yeah,
by Allie.
You know, it was a unique build-up, and like you said, it started as two-year-olds. The first time I rode Affirmed against Allie Darr was in the Hopewell. And that's the day that I really realized what a special horse he was and that Allie Darr was also, you know, because we just, you know, I mean, I'd never at that point in my career accelerated down the stretch, you know, the stretch like I, you know, did in that race. And, you know, they went well clear of the rest of the field. And he held Affirmed beat Allie Darr by, you know, half a length or whatever it was. And then we came back to the New York to Belmont for the Futurity, and I beat him in those. And then, you know, a few weeks later, Allie Darr beat me in the Champagne. So luckily for us, you know, neither we or them were afraid of each other. You know, we both, you know, were very confident in our horses. And Laz kind of talked, you know, kind of challenged them to take us on in the Laurel. We were going to go to Laurel, you know, if Allie Darr can come, if he thinks he's good enough, type of thing.
Right.
And luckily they did, and then, you know, so we beat them in the Laurel Futurity, and, you know, ended up getting the two-year-old champion, you know, that year in the Eclipse Awards. And then, like you said, you know, we went to the West Coast, and they went to the East Coast for the winter, and you know, that was the exciting, you know, build up to the 1978 Derby.
Right, and I mean, you moved to the Derby, and you moved to the Preakness, and now you're on to the Belmont, and I guess Seattle Slough had just won a Triple Crown the year earlier, and Secretariat had won it a few years before that in 1973. But there was still excitement with the Triple Crown, and there was still kind of a belief that Ali Daw would get a measure of revenge in the longer distance, and with that he decided to kind of engage you earlier. And there's a famous race call, and I've always disputed this, and I want to get your opinion on this. There's, and not to criticize, I believe it was Chick Anderson, the race caller, but he said Ali Daw puts a head in front, and I've never really seen that in the stretch into Belmont. Did he ever actually get ahead of you?
He certainly got even with me. Whether he got, if he got ahead of me, it was a nostril, or, it wasn't very far, but, he certainly, he was even with me at one point there. I thought, it was a hell of a call. I mean, I remember, I think Chick Anderson was one of the best of all time, and not only his call with Secretariat, but also that one. It was a heck of a call, and it just showed like two champions. It was almost like a boxing call,
right?
Like it was with those two. It was almost an Ali Frazier kind of back and forth. Nobody knew what was going to happen till we got past the finish line.
Right.
I didn't know. I mean, I knew at the head of the lane that my horse was, he felt a little bit fatigued under me. Aladar was right there fighting, and that's the first time I ever hit him left-handed. But, and being the gutsy horse he was, he just dug in deep and, got his head back in front. And once he did, I just felt like, we were going to hang in there, but which we did. But I think it was Bill Knack that, he said it was like Moby Dick or looking back at Ahab. It was one of those, just a real dogfight, And, the amazing thing was Aladar kept coming back after, all those tight defeats, So, I don't even think he probably ever knew he was losing, He probably thought he won.
Well, there is a certain solace in that for horses' connections, right? That they know they lost, but sometimes the horses don't when it's that tight. I guess Mike Smith said that about Songbird this year when he lost to the Holden. That she's unaware of the fact that the wire came up at the wrong time. Well, through the whole thing, it was so exciting, and I'll tell you an aside on my side. I was selling mutual tickets at Belmont that day.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, and they had a. At that time, they thought it was a good idea not to have television in the bays, so you couldn't watch the races. You couldn't watch the races live where you were working. Watch them on television where you're working, but you could bring. You had to bring your money to the money room after each race. So I remember scrambling up with my money to get to the money room and finding a spot, a perch to watch it on one of the catwalks on the TV.
Right.
And I was younger and probably more interested in it than anybody, and I got a front row seat. And I can see it, and people were asking me what I saw because they couldn't see it. So I delivered a word by word description to the people who couldn't see it. And I had no doubt you had won the photo. It was just tremendously, tremendously exciting. And at such a young age, it just must have been a tremendous amount of pressure. But you handled it with such aplomb, it seemed. And as did the connections of Ali Daw. It was something the whole racing world should have been proud of.
I think they should too. I think, as you say, I think they were very good. John Veach was. I know it killed him, but
right.
It was. Like you said, just like it would have killed us if we'd have gotten beaten the Belmont. Because it would have. We wouldn't have been able to fulfill the dream of trying to win the Triple Crown. But that's what it's all about. That's what sports is about. And kind of. The same, like winning or losing the Super Bowl, it's just the biggest day in racing. And, I thought they did handle it, fantastically well. It was a truly classic fight all the way through.
Right. Just so exciting. And then, we won't go on with it. As it turned out, you weren't riding him when he was disqualified in the Travers, and we've discussed this on our show before. What a shame that was, that was a, a another matchup that never really came to pass because of some you know unfortunate luck on the racetrack.
Yeah.
But you decided to leave New York. You moved to California for a little while. You struggled.
I followed the firm to California. You know, he went back out there for the next. Yeah. You know, so the only reason that I was going to California was really to go with the firm. Yeah,
right.
In Laz, you know. So
and his 4-year old.
Yeah,
right.
And I had done that the winter before, you know, so it wasn't any it wasn't any big deal. The real thing was is I had a fall up at Saratoga that summer and fractured my knee, and I was out for about 2 months or a month and a almost 6 or 8, 7 weeks, I can't remember. When I came back, it was just I had a hard time getting things back, back going again. It was slow to get started, and then soon after that, we went out to California, which obviously wasn't my backyard. My agent Lenny Goodman had a heart attack, and he was recovering from that. And so eventually we got out there, but Laz's horses, it had a long hard year, and they just right at the beginning of the year, they weren't really. That we didn't get off to any kind of a start at all. Just kind of horses were getting beat, that were favorites, and it's one of those things. It doesn't matter how much success you've had, you're only as good as your last win, really, in reality, in anything.
Right.
No matter. Let Tom Brady, lose for a while, and everybody will just say he's washed up.
So that's
what they were saying about me, and they were pretty hard on me pretty quick, and it just kind of, I, without a doubt, I lost some confidence, and just kind of one thing led into another, and I went through a pretty long losing streak, which it sounds, it all happened probably in about 3.5 weeks,
right?
But I never gave up. I mean, I kept fighting and kept trying, and eventually, although I lost the mount on Affirmed, I ended up, finally winning a race for Laz,
Okay.
He gave me a mount on a horse called Father Duffy, and, we had won, and I won a few other races, but it just, it was a struggle, because, all the other California trainers weren't offering me, mounts, or if they were, they weren't offering me good ones, I was just getting scrubs, whatever was left over. And out of the blue, I got an offer to go to Europe. So from an owner who I'd ridden some for out in California, he had sent a few horses out there for the winter, and Robert Sangster, and he had a huge stable over in Europe. Most of his best horses were with Vincent O'Brien, but he also had a pretty good sized stable in England with a trainer called Barry Hills. And so he came and offered me the job to go over to England and ride, for Barry Hills. And they had a pretty good, they'd had a horse called Hawaiian Sound who had just finished second, the year before in the Epsom Derby. And so, he was obviously going to be one of my mounts. And I just decided it was a good time to, try a new challenge and try something different. Things had kind of gone the wrong way for me at that point. And I didn't see any reason not to give it a chance. And the other thing that Mr. Sangster mentioned to me, he says, long term, you're going to end up in Europe anyway because of your weight. And,
right.
As it turned out, that was very true. And after thinking about it, I said, I want to give it a shot. And so I did.
Well, you're being too modest because Robert Sangster and Vincent O'Brien, for our listeners, were really European racing royalty at the time. As you said, they were a huge, powerful stable. And
right.
and for them to reach out to you was had to be a tremendously, supposed to be tremendous pride.
Yeah, I was honored. Like you said, I felt like, it was a shot in my arm, especially at that time. And, went like anything, kind of like Nick Cannon, you want to work for people that want you, So
right.
That was a good time to give it a try.
And that was uncommon at the time. There weren't many riders who went to Europe to ride.
I was the first in a long time. I mean, through history there had been a few, Todd Sloan, and a few others that had gone over, and had some, you know, quite a bit of success, but it hadn't happened for quite a while. Mainly too because American racing had been doing so well, you know, so guys wasn't like the purse structures in England are, you know, on the day-to-day basis they're a little less, you know, the big races are pretty good, but day-to-day, I mean, you know, some of the races are, you know, pretty low, you know, even at what, you know, they consider decent meets.
Right.
So, it wasn't like, you know, I mean, the one thing is, you know, you get a job and you get a retainer, but it wasn't, it wasn't something that a lot of people were dying to rush across there to do. But, my situation, you know, I got a good offer and I thought it was worth, you know, trying.
Well, it was a world of experience for you. I mean, you got to ride and win big races in Great Britain, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy. I was lucky enough to see your victory in the Irish Derby in when you rode Old Vic in 1989.
Right.
I was at the Curragh with my wife and sisters. That was back when I had money and energy and I was working for Pan Am, so we had free flights, so we went to races all over the world, you know. So
cool.
I cashed a bet on you. It was a decent sized price with Old Vic, and
yeah,
it was just tremendous amount of excitement. Now, on a personal note, if I remember correctly, you spent enough time in England that you developed an English accent for a little while. Am I right about that? I definitely did.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, the thing was that I hadn't even turned 19 by the time I went over to England. I was. You know, like about 2 months shy of my 19th birthday. So, you know, I was still young and, you know, I tried to pick up an English accent, but it just kind of like, you know, it just happens, you know, you're around it, you know, you find out what, you know, just you hear other people talk and, you know what they say to get what they want. So, you know, it's easier to do it, you know, if you explain it the way they do, and it just kind of happened. So
right.
I did have a pretty strong accent, but by the time when I got home within a year, it just basically disappeared.
That's funny.
Just from being back home.
I remember, and I don't remember exactly what race it was. I guess it was the English Derby, but I guess a couple of times you've met the Queen at the races, right? When she gives out the trophy, and that's
right.
Got to be
the Queen and the Queen Mother. Were the main two who gave the trophies out at Ascot. And I actually got to know the Queen Mother quite well. And
really?
Obviously met the Queen quite a few times, and, you know, she gave me quite a few trophies through the years. And Princess Anne, got to know her quite well. I met Princess Diana. She was after I won my first Derby on slip anchor. She had gone to the races that day, and you go up to the Royal Box after winning the Derby.
Right.
So that was cool. The fact that royalty's so involved in racing is, you know, a really cool thing in, you know, English racing.
Well, it's hard to imagine people like us working with royalty and being the Queen other than in a racing world. I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about the racing world, right? You get to go everywhere and see everyone.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I met Eric Clapton and Elton John and Roger Waters and all that through racing, you know, because they had some connection one way or the other, and it was pretty cool.
Now, I've told this story on the air before, but I forget which Derby it was. It was the Epsom Derby, and I'm trying to think who won it, but I was there, and Princess Di and Sarah Ferguson were in the Royal Box, and someone streaked down the center of the course. That was all the rage then, people streaking.
Right,
And the Queen stood up and turned her back, and Princess Di stood up and turned her back, but I think Sarah Ferguson was in hot water because, being the American she was, she leaned out of the box and raised the glass and had a few laughs with people as they caught it all the course.
Now they always gave her a hard time. They gave Princess Di, you know, the royal family seemed to give Princess Di a hard time, but they definitely gave Fergie a tough time all the way through. But, I got to meet her, you know, a few times, and she seemed like a really nice gal. And, you know, she seems like she's tried hard to get everything back on track for herself and her kids. So,
right.
You know, I got nothing but good things to say about her.
Well,
that definitely happened in the press over there a lot. They picked and chose who they were fans of and who not.
You know, it shows you
luckily,
how fast.
Overall, they were pretty good to me.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's just a tremendous world of experience. It's amazing how fame is fleeting. I mean, I don't have to tell you. You were famous. I never was. But when I mentioned to my kids, you know, Fergie, they're talking about the singer for the Black Eyed Peas. They don't even realize
right.
It was what somebody was.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
You know, royalty. But well, Steve, you came back and you're back in Kentucky. And
I am.
You're still an ambassador to the game, and I know you make various appearances. What do you think of the state of the game today? I'm sure you're pleased with how it's going, but do you have any particular thoughts about things in the future?
You know, I think there's, you know, certainly good things, and things that are tough. You know, technology's been good in a lot of ways, as you say. I mean, people can be involved with racing and not actually be there, but of course that makes it tough for racetracks and stuff. You know, when people don't actually show up at the venue. I just think racing's kind of, you know, I think at one point there was just too many horses and too many races. You know, I remember before I really started, I guess they said back in the day, you know, there wasn't really racing in the winter in New York or up that in the East.
Right.
And that, you know, the break, you know, whether it was whatever it was, 2 months or 3 months, whatever it was something that was good in the end, because when racing came back, everybody couldn't wait. You know, it's kind of like baseball. I mean, can you imagine playing baseball 365 days a year?
Right.
You know, I mean, the same sort of thing. It's like too much of anything, even a good thing, can, you know, cannot be the best for the sport. So, I think that obviously, you know, keeping the quality up and you know, having maybe slightly less, you know, racing overall is probably something that, you know, is just going to happen naturally. Just I think that's the way it's going to be. You know, that, you know, maybe, like as you said, back in the day, you know, we were racing 6 days a week, you know, year round up in New York. You know, it was just the way it was. And now it's
right.
Like, down to, you know, 4 or 5 days a week up there. And, you know, some places like here at Turfway in Kentucky, it's, you know, in the winter they race about 4 days a week. But, you know, the big thing is, you know, you have to keep the, you know, keep the fans. You have to keep generating and creating new fans, you know. And as you say, there's a lot of young people that, you know, there's just so many other options. You know, back in 1977, 78, you know, there wasn't all the other, you know, I think maybe the lottery was about to come in.
Right.
You know, or came in soon after that, around that time. But, you know, there wasn't legal gambling on all these other things. So, you know, racing's just got a ton more competition, you know. And I just think, you know, I mean, I don't claim to know, all, you know, the answer, you know, so to speak. But I think, you know, obviously somehow we have to attract newer, younger fans and people that, you know, it's kind of like one of the things, you know, once you're around it, you know, it grabs you, you know. But
right.
You have to get people actually to the facility, to the track, and seeing the beauty of horses and, you know, the competition, you know, how great, exciting it is to have a, you know, a race like the Aladara Firm, you know, Belmont, or Sunday Silence and Easy Goer, you know, those kind of things are great fillies, you know, like Ruffian. You know,
right.
Are spectacular performances, and then of course great competition, and you know, I like I said, it's hard to say what there's not exactly one thing. I also kind of tend to think that basically people are right. You know, I mean, we have to have some sort of, unified drug rules, like, and obviously less or, next to none is probably the best, but it has to be universal. You can't have it one way here and one way, it's a different way someplace else. I think it should, be like a universal situation for everybody all around
right.
the country.
Well, it just adds another level of complexity for
right.
gamblers, trainers, owners, everyone involved. I mean,
yeah.
you wind up having people have many drug positives and go unscathed, and other people have minute drug positives and have their reputations tarnished, and it
right.
doesn't seem to everybody.
Seem to be, yeah, it doesn't seem like everybody's getting treated equally. You're right.
Right, the people outside the game don't know what to think. The people inside the game just roll their eyes because they're
lucky ones to get away with it. Yeah, they're happy. they're not. They're basically out of a job. So,
right,
it's pretty tough.
Well, I take some solace in the fact that I think television exposure, and I've written a little article on this, but I think television exposure is really what made other sports gallop ahead of, no pun intended, gallop ahead of.
I agree. Yeah.
Horse racing, and now I am heartened when I hear young people talk about the vagaries of different tracks, the way people used to talk about different ballparks. The idea
right.
that somebody who's 18 years old in New York knows that Hawthorne Racetrack, has tight turns, is something that never could have happened 30 or 40 years ago. You didn't.
Yeah.
You were lucky if anybody knew that it existed. I think the television exposure will help, and I think. I think the game is kind of settling in to a point where, there are big days. I do think that from a gambling standpoint, when we do this show, it seems like every racetrack gives their best races on Saturday, which is a natural. But the Sunday cards are turning out to be weak. So I think some racetracks
right.
should pick up
balance it out. Yeah, you're right. Try to, like you said, especially if you're going up against, New York on Saturday, who's got a huge card. If you're New Jersey or Monmouth or somewhere else, you should move your big races to Sunday. Yeah, I agree.
Right. Yeah, somewhere
try
along
to,
the line.
Try to balance it out.
Yeah, somewhere along the line they thought that the quality on Sunday doesn't matter. And I guess if the quality doesn't matter, why do it on Sunday? But I guess
right.
that would be the one change I would make. And I certainly hope New York gets its act together because they have big old aging facilities. And I don't know how long they're going to be able to keep the facilities that are largely unused, most of the time. So somewhere along the
right.
line, that's got to be modernized. And I hope they bring the Breeders' Cup back to New York. But largely, I'm happy with how the game is shaking out these days. And it's still as exciting as ever, no question about that, right?
Yeah, I mean, when you watch Beholder and Mike's filly, the Songbird, fight it out, that was an amazing race. And of course, Arrogate, coming around and doing what he's done, obviously California Chrome, they're just as you say, there's no end of exciting horses. It's an exciting year every year leading up to the Derby and the Triple Crown races, because you don't know what's going to happen. All of a sudden, a horse can just come on,
right.
And just really develop, right at the right time. They may not make the Triple Crown, but they come good at the Preakness, and then finish the rest of the year and turn into a really superstar. And it's a great game. And as you say, it's just a question of I think I agree with you. I think people were afraid. The racing people were afraid of television. Thinking that it wouldn't. Would keep people away from the track, and to some degree, I guess that's true. But like you said, nowadays they can be involved, wherever they're at, even
right.
if they're not at the track. So, as you say, there's a lot of good things, and the big thing is, hopefully, like you said, more and more young people are starting to understand, more about the game, and it's probably easier in some ways because of the technology to learn, a lot about racing, without actually having to be at the track all the time.
Right. I mean, we have people who call up and tell me about handicapping methods where they watch replays of the races simultaneously from the head on and the pan shot. That's something that,
right.
we couldn't have done.
Never
and it's
said,
a,
no.
Right. Just unbelievable.
No, I mean, I it's great because, you can watch a race anywhere around the country, pretty much any time of the day or night. In the middle of the night, you can watch races in Australia if you want to, in the middle if you want to stay up and you know, and watch it at 2 in the morning, you know.
Steve, you and I are the same age, and so, you know, sleeping gets more difficult as you get older. But I get up in the middle of the night anyway, but I set my alarm for 1:25 in the morning the other day and watched Winx win her 14th straight race in Australia. You know, and my wife just kind of shook her head, you know, and said, well, I should be used to this by now, you know.
Yeah, people that aren't as entwined to it as we are, don't really understand, but I guess it's the same with a lot of things. I don't understand why, you said, why people want to stay up all night and watch Dancing with the Stars or something.
Well, to see Victor Espinosa, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's, that I would stay up for.
Well, Steve, I'm so proud to have you on. I can't thank you enough, and I know you have things to do tonight. I can't thank you enough for being on here. You know, we're a small show, but we put out a quality product, and we have loyal listeners, and we just, you know, each week we try to speak with racing personalities, and I really didn't want, you know, the 40-year anniversary of you setting New York on fire in February to go unnoticed, I can't tell you how thankful we are for being on, and what a great response we've gotten from people who are excited to hear this interview. So I can't thank you enough. Please, I certainly hope you won't be a stranger, and I hope
all the
when
best
we get
to you, and like you said, keep watching the races and going to the track and enjoying, you know, the greatest sport on earth.
Great, thank you so much, Steve Cawthon, everyone. Thanks again, Steve.
Okay, buddy. All the best.